Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Creating a Family. Talk about adoption and infertility. I'm Dawn Davenport, the director of Creating a Family. We're a nonprofit providing education, resources, and support for both adoption and infertility. You can find us online at creatingafamily.org. The Creating a Family radio show is supported by our corporate sponsor, Ferring Pharmaceutical. Ferring is proud to introduce their new Heart Plus Pharmacy Savings Card, which helps patients, both cash-paying and insured, save money on their fertility meds. You can get more information about this from your doctor, of course, or from the FerringFertility.com/heart website, or you can call them at 1-888-FERRING for more details about available savings and how you can receive a Heart Plus Pharmacy Savings Card. I blog weekly on subjects usually relevant to infertility or adoption. My blog this week is on parenting teens, actually just teens in general, although they happen to be adopted in my house, but nonetheless, teens in general, and I talk about what I consider to be the unfortunate bad rap that I think teens get and how you need not fear your kids' teen years. Check it out and leave your thoughts. You can get this blog at creatingafamily.org/blog. And why not connect with me over on the social networks? We talk about all sorts of topics relevant to infertility and adoption. And you can find me on Twitter at DawnDavenport1. On Facebook, I'm Dawn.Davenport1. And you can also join the Creating a Family Facebook support group. The easiest way to find that group is just to type in Creating a Family in the search box under Facebook. And it will be the one that pops right up. We upload a video a couple of times a month. A video that you might find helpful is Adopting from Ethiopia and Other African Countries. You can find this video on our adoption video page at our website under Adoption Resources, or you can access it on the Creating a Family channel on YouTube. This show, as well as all the resources provided by Creating a Family, could not happen without the generous support of all of our sponsors, including Nightlight Christian Adoption. They are pioneers of the first embryo adoption program called Snowflakes. They started this program in 1997, and so far have had over 260 babies have been born. If you are trying to choose an adoption agency or an attorney or looking for an infertility clinic or doctor or a donor or surrogacy agency or therapist, we now have a searchable database to help you select just the right one for you. You can search by location or services provided or years in operation or any host of other criteria that we think are important when choosing. These are agencies and professionals who have chosen to support us, and their support allows us to continue to bring you this show and all of our resources. So if you've benefited from any of these resources, we hope that you will support those who do support us. Today's show is on creating attachment in the first year home, and we're going to be talking about what adoptive parents can do in that first year to encourage bonding. Our guest is Dr. Joyce McGuire-Pavo. She is the founder and CEO for the Center for Family Connections in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Dr. Pavo is a clinical member of both the American Association of Marriage and Family Therapy and the American Orthopsychiatric Association. She's a lecturer in psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, and she says her most valuable credential is that she has experienced life as an adoptive person and that she has great love and respect for both her birth and her adoptive families. Welcome, Joyce, to Creating a Family.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
I thought we would organize the show today roughly by age at adoption. I mean, much of the same information will apply regardless of the age of the child when the child was adopted, but there are some definite differences that do appear by age as well. So let's start by talking about newborn infants placed right after birth. I mean, for all parents, regardless if their child was born into the family or adopted into the family. The whole concept of attachment parenting is quite popular right now. So what do you consider to be attachment parenting? And then second, should adoptive families with a newborn do anything more than what parents by birth are doing?
I would say yes and no. I think that one of the things that people often misconstrue, bonding only happens in utero. So it's the birth parent who has that bonding, the birth mother. Even the birth father and the birth mother have to go through an attachment process after the child comes into the world. And so I think that, you know, often adoptive parents think that they're experiencing something very different than what the birth family would experience, and that's not exactly true. I do think that the adults really need to do their homework. And most adults do a lot of preparation prior to giving birth to a baby or prior to adopting a child into their family. But I think that especially with adoption, it's important to have supports, to be looking at your own triggers for trauma and loss. Anyone who's been through infertility and losses of that sort is really much like a birth parent in the fact that they have also lost children that they hoped they could raise but couldn't for various reasons. So I think getting in touch with those issues is extremely important. And for the birth parent who's going to be placing a child for adoption, a newborn, it's very important. I think that a lot of birth parents or surrogates are keeping themselves very separate from the child and not wanting to bond because they're not going to raise this child. That is not in the best interest of the child. We want to encourage the birth parent or the surrogate to be connecting and bonding to that child, because we know so much these days about what an impact that has on the child right from the very beginning.
Well, you raised an interesting point that I wanted to raise, and I also hear, and we have a question that I'm going to lead into here, I also hear from parents by birth who also don't feel that immediate attachment to their child, and they worry. But I think it's compounded when the parent is an adoptive parent. Here's a question from Leslie. She said, I did not bond to my son right after he came home. Did my failure cause him harm? He's 6 months now, and I'm totally bonded.
Well, I think that it's a process. I mean, it's like an arranged marriage. All of a sudden, you have this person that you're connecting to. And I again think that if the adults have done some of their homework, I think that most people are so excited about finally starting their family or adding to their family, and it's very difficult when the child isn't immediately in love with the parent. And many of these children, all of these children, have gone through some loss. Some have gone through additional traumas in utero or soon after. And it's a different process because of that. So I think parents need a lot of support not to feel rejected themselves if the child isn't immediately snuggly-wiggly and in love with them.
But what I point out is that there are plenty of parents by birth who also feel this way. The arrival of a child into your family is a huge disruption. It's a huge change, and different people respond to that in different ways. If you've given birth, you also have the hormonal component thrown in to boot. I think sometimes the fear of, oh my gosh, I'm doing something wrong to my child, or I'm doing something wrong, I'm at fault, I'm not normal, because I don't feel this immediate head over heels falling in love feeling. And I think that plenty of people grow into love with their children, not fall into love.
Absolutely. I think that the distinction is that this child who has already suffered one disconnection and loss is coming into this family in a different way than the child that's born into this very family. And
sure.
And that's definitely a key piece, because I think the perceived and real attachment process, and I say perceived and real because sometimes people are assuming things that aren't actually happening because of their own insecurities, which are very normal.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that it's very important that we realize there are these traumas and losses that have come before for the child by adoption that haven't necessarily been there for the child that's born into the family, and that can make a difference in the process of attachment. And I think often gets misjudged as attachment disorder, when in fact I think it's a very normal thing if you've had some disruption and some loss to be a little more skeptical. The first developmental stage is trust-mistrust, and the first thing that happens to a child, an infant who's being placed for adoption, is they're experiencing loss, and their trust is shifting.
What are some practical things that parents of newborns through adoption or birth, but in this case, let's focus on adoption, what can they do to help foster attachment, both their attachment to the child and the child's attachment to them?
And I think that's a very important distinction, that it really is a dance. You can't have attachment. It's not a one-way street. It requires both sides. So I think that the parents really, have the opportunity to do quite a bit to make sure they're doing a lot of gazing into the eyes of this child, really connecting to the child in various ways. I think if it's I'm getting into a slightly older than infant discussion when I go here, but if you're adopting a child from another country, an infant or a young baby from another country, it's important that the smells, the feels be consistent for a while. I think it's very usual for parents to want to immediately put their child in some Baby Gap clothes and scrub them up with some delicious lavender soaps. But I think that that child needs to have the continuity of the smells and feels that are familiar as they get used to their new people, their new connections, their new family.
As long as we're talking about international, I would add that, keeping the foods, buying, one of the things that I encourage people to do is to buy formula in the country that the child has been using. Try to get the nipple and or the bottle, either the exact bottle and nipple if it was possible, if not one from that country. As you say, to keep as many things as similar as possible to ease the transition.
Absolutely. Transitions are extremely important. Transitions can make or break the whole situation, and I think that we have a history of not paying enough attention to those transitions. So what you're suggesting is absolutely important. And when you think about it, think about children you're already connected with that you're raising. If you are going out of town and leaving your child with your sister for an overnight while you go on a business trip, or if you are even going out for the evening with your partner to a movie and you leave your child with a babysitter, you explain what this child likes, how they like to eat, how it's best to put them to bed. You give a lot of information so that the transition, you want this to go well, you want it to be smooth, you want the child to be safe and comfortable. And I think the same is absolutely true and necessary during the big transition from family to family. And I think it's hard for people to understand the real importance of all of that, especially if they don't approve of some of the foods or some of the things that were familiar to the child. It's not that you need to keep them forever, but there needs to be a connection to the person and then a slow transition.
Going back to newborns, one of the things that I think is important and would like to get your opinion is to slow down. So often when we have a new baby coming into the house, there's a lot of activity. And also sometimes people have taken off from work. Life seems very hectic. And then I think one of the things you can do to help bond with a newborn is to slow down, simplify, even if that's not your personality, to do it for a short time so you really have time with that child. To really focus on that child. I love what you call eye gazing, so that you can sit there and marvel over the wonder that is this child. Do you find that is helpful as well?
Absolutely. I think that it's sort of like a nice little slow motion in a movie. If you can really slow it down and really build a relationship with this infant, it's so important. And it's hard to do that with all your in-laws and your relatives coming in and saying, oh, you should do this, you should do it this way. I mean, which is very helpful, and we always want to have those kinds of supports. But when you're beginning your attachment process from the adult end to the child, it's important that you begin to feel comfortable, that you figure out your ways of being with this child, and that, talking to this child, explaining things, of course they're not understanding it on one level, but on every level they're picking up on the tone, the feelings, the connection that you're making to them, and I think it's extremely important to give yourself time to do that. This is the building of a relationship, and I think it's important to see it that way.
All right, any other tips for attachment to newborns?
I think one of the most important things is if this child has suffered any trauma, and we know they've suffered loss, they may, and even a child who's perfectly had the most normalized situation, they can certainly have colic, can have crying jags, can have different, they can feel inconsolable at times.
Mm-hmm.
It's so important for new parents, especially new adoptive parents, not to feel personalized, not to feel
Amen.
That they can't do, that something's wrong with them if this baby is crying. It's very important to stay calm and to really, really work at figuring out what is going on for this child and how to help them, but not to lose faith in the fact that you can do what's needed for this child. But this child comes with some extra challenges, not by his or her own doing. It's not necessarily anything to do with genetics. The experiences this child has had are going to result in some kinds of behaviors that may be difficult. And I think sometimes people get so depressed by that and feel like, oh, I can't do anything right. If I were the birth mother, this wouldn't be happening. And it's just not true. It doesn't have to do with that. It has to do with the loss, with the separation, and with some of the experiences internally that this child is dealing with.
And it's important to remember, having been the mother of one of my children had colic, and it was extremely difficult. Children have colic, and we really don't know the reasons why. There's lots of theories out there. In truth, we really don't know the reason why. And it is very hard when your child is crying and you can't console your child to not take it personally. You feel like a failure because a good mother is supposed to be able to nurture and make this child feel better. And it's just so hard when you can't. And it doesn't matter really how that child came to you. It doesn't matter. It's still hard. And I love what you said about don't personalize it. Not easy to do, but it is, and it's important to talk with other parents who've had children with colic. And I always point out that this particular kid is such a, it's also not indicative of how this kid is going to be or indicative of your continuing inability to console the child. Colic almost always resolves. And the particular child of mine is just a charming young man now and, you know, totally connected, totally bonded. Went through what seemed like a forever period of time, and it was really helpful for me to connect with other parents who had had children with colic so that they could assure me, and it also helped, quite frankly, that he wasn't my first. But
Right.
I think had he been my first, it would have been even harder, quite frankly.
Absolutely. And I think that you can always call your pediatrician. It may be a change of form. This child may have had difficulty in utero, may have had certain feeding problems in the transition. Mm-hmm. There could be so many reasons and so many things that might be helpful that you may not be thinking of and that have nothing to do with the fact that you should be thinking of them.
Exactly.
And I think
hint.
That's so important. It really is.
It is, and swaddling is often quite effective. Things that you would not have known, in fact, seem quite uncomfortable. A lot of movement, just unusual things that you should not be expected to think of that might work, and your pediatrician and or other parents can give you hints on some of these things.
And sometimes this is a matter of a little time so that there can be, you know, maybe things aren't fully formed. Maybe this child is still developing in certain ways. And
they actually
it never lasts forever. It's really important to realize that. And I don't know, most colic happens late in the day. It's a hectic time of day. People are coming home from work and school. Mm-hmm. And so it's really important to figure out, that's when you really want to simplify things and figure out how to get the support you need.
And get help.
Yep.
Sometimes what you need is just another set of arms in the house, somebody to take the baby outside or to allow you to get outside and get away from the baby.
Absolutely.
All right. Here's a question from Debbie. She said, what can be done to facilitate the bonding process while you are in your child's country? She is adopting internationally, and she's wanting some ideas for bonding while in country. So one way to look at that is bonding both while you're in country but also immediately after meeting the child.
again, bonding isn't the correct term, because bonding only happens in utero. But how to attach, how the attachment process can be helped in another country is very important. And I think one of the things to make sure and to insist, and I think that pre-adoptive parents are very nervous, especially if they're in an international situation and they don't have the language, et cetera. But insist with the people that you're working with that they give you the opportunity to meet with some of the caregivers, that you get to hear what are the things that calmed this child when he or she was upset, what are the things this child enjoys, you know, really getting a sense of who this child is. Again, you do this when you're leaving your child with a babysitter. You explain some of these things. We sort of send these children off without any information from their previous setting and what worked for them in some instances. It happens domestically as well as internationally, but of course it's more likely to happen in an international situation. So I think, as you said, finding the things that are the same so the transition can be slow. If there is a certain food, if there is a certain bottle, if there is a blankie that's, even if you hate it and it's your worst favorite color, and, you know, I mean, whatever is familiar to that child that's going to help with the transition as the child gets used to your smell and your touch and being with you, if they have some things that come with them as well, they don't feel as cut off from everything. That sense of touch and the sense of smell are the senses that you come with and that you leave with. And those are most important. So I think really paying attention to those is pretty key. And then I think, you know, most parents are really good at figuring out what kinds of things to get so that not just now, they may not be returning to this country until the child is 12 or 13. So what kinds of things would you want to bring with you that you can share with this child over time and tell stories about what this means to you and what it meant to them and in their country of origin?
And one thing it's important to note, depending on the country that you're adopting from, it quite frankly may not even be possible for you to talk with the caregiver. That it is the reality of certain countries, that's simply not an option. The child is put in new clothes, brought to you. It's not even the same clothes the child is used to themselves. And you just need to know that it's not going to cause permanent damage. It would be better if you could get the other information, both information, objects, things like that. But if you can't, don't make that a problem in and of itself.
No, but I do think that most situations on both sides don't know what they don't know. I mean, I think that the sending country, the caregivers are doing what they think you'll like the most. They're putting the child in this new outfit and they're bringing the child to you. But if you ask, and if you ask the translator and you say, I would love to just spend a few minutes and to learn some things, the caregiver is having a loss also. If there's been any connection and attachment for the child in the country of origin, this is a great opportunity to also help that person to feel that this child is going to be really well cared for. Someone really is asking the kinds of questions that you would hope to hear. And I don't think that it's always done by the people who are doing the process, but it doesn't mean the families can't ask for it.
We got a question, which I'm so glad, because not infrequently, it's certainly not the most common yet, but we are seeing more children adopted internationally that have been in foster care in their home country prior to coming home. So here's a question. Any tips for families that are adopting a child that has been in foster care in their home country? How do you smooth the transition from being with the foster family to being with the parents?
The same thing that I said before. I think that if you can have the opportunity to meet the foster parents, if you can, you know, have the opportunity to take pictures of yourself and the child and the foster parents and make sure they have copies as well, because often there are other children in that family who will experience a loss when this baby leaves. I think on both sides, those kinds of connections, those kinds of transitions, the attention to attachment that has happened and that's going to happen is very, very important. And, you know, one of our staff just came back from a trip to China. Her two girls are from China, and they were able to meet one of the daughter's foster mothers when they were there, and it was so wonderful. It happened at the very last minute in their trip to the area where this child came from. And it's so important to have those connections and to foster them in various ways, not only for the attachment development and for the transition, but also for future reference.
Mm-hmm, very much so. If it is possible, and it may not be, but if it is possible for the adoptive parents to go to the home where the child is living and just be in the home, not necessarily becoming the parent per se, but to be sitting there watching the interactions and to have the child sense and see the communication and the contact between the foster parents and the adoptive parents. Again, not always possible, but wonderful if it is. And one of the things that we as an adoption community can do is try to help educate sending countries as to the importance that this type of stuff is important, both, as you point out, right now, but also for the future.
Absolutely, for both sides. And, you know, this child, all of these people have a huge input into the life of this child, their psychological and emotional life, for whatever length of time they were in that home. That's a part of their story, a part of their life. It's just like, think about, I don't know if your children are old enough to have gone off or going off to college, but I can't imagine not having seen the dorm room where my daughter was going to be when she went off to college, that, mm-hmm. you know, that I could then picture where she was going to be. And I think the same thing for, you know, picking the child up from a certain place, that you have seen where they were, will not only be helpful to you in making sense of what might have been before, but also as the child develops and is able to hear the stories and learn more, it's very important to tell them some truths and some stories about their lives.
Mm-hmm. Very much so. One of my pet peeves is when I hear parents say that their newly adopted child has attachment issues or, heaven forbid, reactive attachment disorder when they've only been home for a month or two. Can you tell a child with real attachment issues within the first month home?
You know, I am very skeptical about using any kind of attachment language regarding kids, unless we're absolutely, I think it's really used very, very loosely. And I think it's worrisome, because, and it depends on the story of the child. As I said before, any child who has experienced loss, and all adopted children have experienced loss, even if they were the Juno kind of story and the adoptive parents were present at the birth, there is still a loss involved. So all children have experienced loss, and many have experienced trauma, maybe in utero, maybe afterwards, but there has been some trauma for some of these children as well. When you have trauma and loss in the mix, it's very hard to tell what is attachment and what is trust issues because of the trauma and loss. And I think that, you know, it makes every bit of sense why if you were hurt by people directly or indirectly and people disappeared when you expected to see them there, why would you possibly automatically trust and simply go forward? I actually think it's quite normal for children in these transitions to be a little reluctant in the attachment process. And so I don't see that as a problem. I see it as a given because of the loss and the trauma. And I think that if we understood that a little better and didn't jump to conclusions, this is not a lifelong issue. It gets amended pretty quickly once children become safe, secure, and settled in their forever family. They lose some of that. Some of it stays forever because it's part of the fabric of who they are. But the same kinds of reactions to it are not there over time.
How long should a parent wait before they start worrying then?
See, I think if parents are worrying, they're going to inhibit the attachment process because their anxiety is going to get in the way. The child needs the parent to be pretty secure. And so I think that if a parent feels that kind of ambivalence, that kind of anxiety, they need to get some help. They need to get supports, and they need to be able to deal with their own portion of this, because it is a two-way street. And if the parent isn't, you know, is feeling so worried that the child isn't going to attach, that they're anxious, they're going to inhibit the attachment.
So what are the signs of an attachment problem? I mean, in other words, what are kind of the red flags that a parent should be cognizant of?
Well, see, I think I don't really like to give a list of things like that, because each child is different, each parent is different. But what I do want to reiterate is that the trauma, and it's so important to be cognizant of the trauma and the loss, and to realize that it's normal for these children, these babies, these infants, these toddlers, these kids, to have a reluctance and a slower process, or to have an over-connection because of fear of loss. I mean, so some of those indicators that people so quickly identify as attachment or reactive attachment disorder are, to me, normal under the circumstances. And if we don't overreact to them, but if we work with them in certain ways, I think they even themselves out.
I love this question from Crystal. She said, could you please talk about the best ways to handle tantrum/outbursts that result from the transition? I assume she means the transition home.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I think that these are children who are freaked out. I prefer the child who has tantrums, and we see a lot of families where kids have like 4-hour tantrums, and really it is absolutely it's just nerve-wracking to be around them, and it's freaky for the poor new parent to deal with. But I'll tell you, I think those kids are demonstrating something very, very real. I'm more worried about the child who everyone thinks is easy and has settled in quickly, who's really in a state of shock. Because it is shocking, especially the international adoptions, to leave a place, get in a plane, be somewhat dehydrated, fly across the world, and then to arrive somewhere that's absolutely different than anything one has ever experienced. It is a shocking experience, and it is a frightening experience. And you wake up and nothing's the same. You can just put yourself in the shoes of this baby, and you can experience how shocking it is and how difficult it is. And people react in different ways. It manifests itself either in a shutdown or perhaps in this kind of a tantrum. I think one of the most important things is to make a child feel safe. You know, again, if it's a baby, swaddling that child, doing, you know, finding all the different ways that you will have to learn to calm this child down, because this child is going to have these experiences until they're comfortable and safe and secure. And we don't know what their pacing is, because each child will be different. But I think parents need a lot more prediction about this, because this is the point at which the attachment can go awry, not just because of the child, but because of the parent's reaction to that child.
One of the things that I think is so helpful, both interestingly enough, I believe it's helpful for the parents but and for the child, is to start as quickly as possible giving your child cues as to what's going to happen in their day, routines, in other words, because that starts calming a child. Oftentimes they simply need some way to predict what's happening in their lives and what's going to happen. And it gives them some sense of control. So the more routines you can establish, and not necessarily rigid, but fairly firm for a while, I think that has a tremendous calming effect.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Depending, of course, on the child, but the vast majority of children could use something like that. Debbie writes and says, would it be beneficial to line up a checkup with an attachment therapist during the first year to get feedback on how things are going?
Well, I find that very difficult to answer, because you've heard my little philosophy about this. And I think if you're looking for problems, you're going to find them. If you're going to someone, I don't know. I worry because there are so many fabulous people doing work in attachment, and it's such a piece of work that's so integral to children entering families, et cetera. But I also worry that it's an industry, and I worry about who you might be going to see. I think it would be great to go and see someone who has expertise in adoption and maybe trauma, who can assess your family and what kinds of supports you might need and the child and what kinds of supports they may need. I think those kinds of things are very useful. At our center, we have people who come for 50,000-mile checkups. They come maybe once, maybe twice a year, whether things are good or bad. And it's great to get a baseline of when things are good. So I love it when people come in and everything's fine. They're just coming to say, this is where we're at, this is what's going on, what do you think might happen in the future, like I have a crystal ball. And but I think it's a wonderful thing, and people do take advantage of that kind of thing. It's like, I mean, you bring your car in for 50,000-mile checkups, you go to the dentist for, you know, checkups, you go to your doctor for well visits. I think it's good to have someone that you go to, not only when things are good, but when they're difficult, that you build a trusting relationship with. And I don't think it has to be a specialist in terms of attachment or trauma, but it does have to be someone who understands the umbrella issues of adoption.
And I share your worry that we can medicalize or that we can turn what is normal into a problem just by treating it as a problem. And I also worry about people seeing someone who is going to, because you're coming to them for an attachment assessment, is going to find an attachment issue. So I don't know that we have an answer to Debbie. Yes, if you have somebody that you are working with that you think is very good and very knowledgeable, but most people don't have that. So unless they're anticipating problems before their child comes home. So I guess the question is, if you don't have anybody lined up, do you need, just as a preventative measure, to try to find somebody?
Well, yeah, I think you may at some point want to see someone just to, you know, a lot of people come to our clinic and they just want to know if everything's going well, is it normal for their child to have this issue? And, you know, many times under the circumstances of the beginnings of that child's life and of the transition into this family, it is normal that they have some challenging behaviors or some things that are going on. So I think it's good to talk to someone who can give you a little support around that. It needs to be someone that you trust and that has some expertise, there are a lot of people who say that they are adoption experts because they've worked with three adoptive families or because their sister is adopted or because, I think you have to have had some training. You have to understand developmental psychology. You have to understand trauma. You do have to understand attachment. You have to understand the importance of diversity training and understanding the cultural differences for kids, especially with older children. And it's just very important that people who are working with adoptive families have some understanding about the bigger picture of adoption, because otherwise it's very easy to pathologize everyone involved in adoption. They are dealing with different challenges than people in families by birth.
That's the word I was looking for before, pathologize. I do worry that we do that in general, and it's a fine line, because we also, as you point out, there are a lot of people doing good stuff, and quite frankly, I'm a firm believer that the more support that's out there, the better. But I feel that same way about learning differences. It's that fine line.
Sure.
Do you label your child or do you not label your child? There's advantages to both, and it's a it's a very fine line for a parent to walk. Here we've got actually quite a few questions, believe it or not. I'm choosing just one to read. On sleeping arrangements, I think I'll read this one from Ron. He says, my wife and I are disagreeing over the sleeping arrangements for our soon-to-be adopted toddler. She wants the family bed, and I think that thinks that it is essential for bonding. I am not so sure. And then we have a number of others, co-sleeping questions in general. All right, so weigh in. How important do you think the sleeping arrangement is? If it matters by age, then
I think it matters
by
age, and I think it matters by, you know, what the family configuration is. And it depends on where this child has been. You know, if this child has been in a place with many different people and babies and is used to a lot of activity, a lot of noise, the comfort is in the group feel, then it may be very, very helpful. It may be hard to put that baby or that infant or that toddler alone in a room when they've never been alone. You know, they've been in a room with 8 other babies or and 12 other kids or something like that. So I do think the transition for a child to having their own space needs to be a transition. And I do think it is important for connection and attachment to be able to understand this child is going to have, especially if it's an international adoption, is going to have some jet lag, it's going to wake up fearful, and it may just be easier for the parents. I mean, a lot of parents of newborns end up bringing the baby into bed when they have to feed them anyway. I mean, they may start out trying to have them sleep in their crib, but it makes it easier for the adults sometimes to have the child close by. So I think that, you know, looking at the whole situation, making a decision that's good. One of the things that we see a lot of here at the clinic is parents who have started out, especially single parents who have started out having the child stay in their bed and now can't get the child back to their own room. And that's a difficult thing. And there needs to be a transition for that as well. We often recommend, you know, sort of a camping out situation where the child can start out in their own room and can come in and sleep on a pallet, on a futon, on a little sleeping bag, you know, in the parent's room and then be taken back to their bed. The transition needs to be there so that the child feels comfortable. And you don't know whether this child is legitimately feeling unsafe in the night and fearful or whether they're just, you know, doing kid things and trying to get attention. So I think it is important to think about the whole picture, to think about, you know, the age of this child, to think about where they were and where they're going to be and how they're going to best transition in a safe, safe way. And I mean emotionally and psychologically safe.
And from the standpoint, and that we would feel that regardless. So you're not against co-sleeping?
I think it can be a good transition, and it can be very important. It has to be for the right reasons and done in the right way. And I think that, you know, ultimately, and if you have a couple and they're totally on, not even in the same book, let alone on the same page, if this set of parents are discussing this before the child has even come home, and they have very differing views about it, I would recommend that they go and talk to someone about that. And that they have a chance to both be heard and that then they think about the particular child that's coming into their life and to think about it then in view of the best interest of that child. And one or the other of them may be right for now. One or the other of them may be right for a little later. This may need a transition, but it may not need to be the permanent plan. All of that needs to be talked about. This is a great opportunity to talk about the differing parenting views that they already have before the child has even come home, which is normal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we are all individual and unique, and children can handle. I think we assume that parents have to be on the same page with everything all the time, and that's not been my experience. I think kids can handle that. Parents feel differently about things as long as it's not. We're not sending mixed messages to the child or too vastly different on something of major importance.
Right.
Here's a question from Diane. She said, what advice do you have for building attachment in older children adopted from foster care where abuse is an issue?
Well, I think that, again, it's not that different than what I talked about. We know that every child who's adopted comes with loss. And many come with trauma. We know that from the Child Welfare League that something like 98% of children over age 3 who are adopted, and this is both international and domestic, have suffered abuse or neglect. And we know that children from the child welfare system have suffered abuse or neglect, or they wouldn't be in the child welfare system. they're there because of care and protection. There has been physical or sexual abuse and neglect that has led to their removal and to their placement. And so that it's important that we first understand that, because before we even talk about any issues around adoption or attachment, we need to look at the trauma and the loss. How many losses, how many moves has this child had? How many people have disappeared? And I mean lots of people, not just their birth families and their extended families, but have they been in three different foster homes? Have they, you know, got picked up after school one day and never went back to say goodbye to the people who had been their family for the last year? What have they been through? To understand their feeling, to put yourself in their shoes, to sort of understand why they wouldn't trust that they're really going to stay. Everyone else told them they were going to stay at the last place. Why should they believe it this time? It's very important for people to understand the impact of trauma and how kids are coping with it and what they're doing, and to know that it's going to be some work to develop trust. And it's not necessarily that they don't trust you, the person. They don't trust grown-ups. Grown-ups have not done a good job for them. You know, they've changed schools, they've changed therapists, they've changed social workers. There's a different person in their life every other day, and nobody has stayed and done anything for them. And even though you're supposed to be their forever family, maybe they were told that two foster families ago as well, and that didn't work. So it's incredibly important to realize these are kids who need work developing trust, and it's not indicative of huge attachment disorders or reactive attachment disorders. It makes sense. Why would you trust anyone if you'd been through what they've been through?
Let me point out, too, to Diane, that we did a show on raising a child who has been sexually abused on March 9th of this past year. And she can listen to that show as well on the radio page of our site. Go to the 2011 Big List and just click on the, let's see what day I'm going to tell you. It was the March 9th show. So what you're basically saying is some of the same advice, develop routines, spend, slow things down, keep things as much as the same as possible during the transition period. You would apply to a child that is older. There would be very little difference. And also not, as you had said before, not pathologizing issues, knowing that in this case, their distrust is probably a fairly healthy response to a distrustful world that they've been exposed to.
Absolutely. And I think that structure is safety. So developing really clear structures, and that's easier for some people than others. Some people are very good at setting limits and structures. And I don't mean setting limits in an austere way.
No.
I think this child is going to feel a lot safer if they know what's expected. It's like they've been in different worlds. Every family has their own culture and their own way of doing things. They need to learn as quickly as possible what's expected, how it's done. They're going to fight it sometimes, and, you know, what are the repercussions? Are you going to throw them out? Are you going to hit them? These things have happened to them in other instances. They're going to be trying to find out, you know, what is this place and what are the rules? How does it work? So really, I think that a lot of adoptive parents, pre-adoptive parents, start out by, you know, their heart is on their sleeve, and they realize the terrible trauma this child has experienced, and so they want to go the other way and be very accommodating and just give this child everything. Well, the problem is eventually you're going to need to set limits, and if you don't set them from the beginning, it's very hard to switch gears.
Amen.
Set gentle ones right from the beginning, and make sure that you understand the reason you're doing this is structure is safety. These are kids who have suffered trauma. They need to know what's going to happen. They need to be able to predict so that nothing surprises them or triggers them in different ways. And so I think it's really important. It's a little counterintuitive. You just want to hug them and give them goodies and make sure they're, you know, they're comfortable in their new home. You want to, you know, but they're not a guest. They're not there for the weekend. The plan is that you're going to adopt this child. So you need to set these rules right from the beginning, gently but clearly.
I think that is such good advice. you know, at first you think, well, it doesn't really matter if they go to bed when we set the bedtime. You know, what does it matter if they stay up later? What does it matter if they don't make up their bed or whatever it is your family rules are? But from a child, then it seems like there is nothing. They're just floating out there or as a guest in your home. I also think that families can structure the environment to help set some of the limits for them. You see people who inundate their children immediately, again, out of a sense of they've had so little, so let me give them everything. And the child is overwhelmed by the amount of stuff that is presented to them, and perhaps is not taking good care of it, and then the families get frustrated. It's easier to have a very simple environment, have very simple a physical environment that sets certain limits for the child as well. Don't put them in an environment where a lot of things are being thrust upon them that are easy to break, for instance. If you don't want them doing something, then just don't have it around.
Exactly. Child-proof your home, depending on the age of the child. Mm-hmm. Pay attention to those things in advance. Absolutely.
Here's a question from Georgia. I'm a single mom. I am white. My son is black. We look so different, so alien to each other. I wonder if the visual differences between us will inhibit his attaching to me.
Well, you know, I think that the visual differences between them will be visible to other people and will cause people to, you know, ask questions or say things. It's important to have communication about race and adoption. And I think that, you know, developmentally you do it in different ways. Most three-year-olds are already looking at same and different. And so it's important to talk about the sameness and the difference and to explain, you know, your mommy Sandra has skin like yours, but I'm your everyday mommy and I don't. And, you know, to find the ways to acknowledge that your skin is beautiful and it's that color because your birth family is like you in that way. But we're like each other in other ways. We love to giggle and play together. We like to cook together. We like to do, you know. I mean, I think that it's important to talk about sameness and difference and to acknowledge it. I think one of the dangers is ignoring it. And then what we learn with adult adoptees in focus groups who are transracially adopted is that no one ever mentioned race. And that it really, really wasn't brought up and couldn't be brought up, and that it felt like that was something really off course. You just couldn't touch it. And it's so important for kids to have the modeling and the understanding of how to talk about this, because other people, their friends are going to say, how come your mom's white and you're black?
Mm-hmm.
And the child has to have some sound bites, some ways to say, oh, well, I have a tummy mummy and she's the same color skin as me, but my mommy that I live with every day doesn't. Or whatever the normal answer is for that particular child, it's important that it be acknowledged, because it's true and it's visible.
We've got actually two questions that came in. One just came in on the role to allow that we should allow for grandparents in that first year, and how that role may affect attachment. Let me read this from Jerry. She said, the best piece of advice we received after we adopted our first son was limit the amount of time your child spends with others. Being the first grandchild, we allowed everyone to hold our son. And while we're not certain that helped his attachment issues, we certainly could have helped his attachment to us by limiting time that grandma held him. With our second son, we were much more stingy with the time anyone else held him for that first year. There's a noticeable difference between the two boys. I'll be interested to hear what you have to say, because I have an opinion that's not always as well received in the adoption world on this issue. So go ahead, tell us first.
Can you just repeat a little bit of that again? I was trying to pay
attention. Well, the gist of the question is, we often tell, and this is pretty much the other question that we received on this as well, we tell newly adopted parents that they should be the only ones caring for and handling and touching their child. But as in Jerry's case, their first son was the first grandchild in the family, so grandparents undoubtedly want to come in. How much contact should we allow grandparents to have with newly adopted children?
Well, I think that families are families, and it's really important. There are no people in the world who don't have attachment to more than one person. And certainly, I think you want the parents, especially the primary parent, to, if there's going to be one person who's at home with the child for a certain amount of time or whatever, to feel, it's more about making the adult feel secure that this is their child. And I think that that's an important piece. So there may be some little bit of time where it's important to spend, to really get to know your child. I talked about it with the infant, really developing a relationship with this child. But in no way does that mean that the grandma can't come over and pick up the baby. And, of course, she'll give you all the instructions in the world about how you should be doing everything. Mm-hmm. And that's fine, but you need to figure that out. You, the parent, need to figure that out. And, of course, you'll have to have a babysitter while you go to the store and get more diapers or whatever. I mean, there are situations where you really can't. We're not independent beings. We're interdependent beings. So, of course, there will be other people involved. But it is very important to develop a very special relationship from the beginning. And I think that that is the way that, and more for the parent than the child, the way that the parent begins to feel that attachment.
Well, then this is surprising because you and I agree absolutely with what you just said. I do think, because we get this question a surprising amount, I think that there is a lot of advice out there that newly adopted families should be the only ones caring for their children. And yet I think that there's other forms of attachment that you're also seeking. I think the grandparent-grandchild attachment is crucial. It's just
absolutely
wonderful.
Absolutely.
And if you tell a grandparent, no, you can't cuddle with this child, I think that that does impact. So I think we have gone overboard, and you said it beautifully, that it does need to be. There is a primary relationship, but that primary relationship is likely not going to be impacted by a grandma coming in, feeding and cuddling the child, as long as she is not the primary one doing it.
Right.
And also understanding, of course, if the child is reacting poorly, then you adjust the advice based on the child, but that we could. There's enough, as you point out, we all have multiple attachments, and having just one exclusive attachment is not only not good, but as a parent, you can use a break periodically. And so it's nice to have, if the grandparent lives nearby, and even if the grandparent doesn't, to encourage the grandparent to have a very special role in that child's life is a blessing.
Most people who do, international adoptions bring someone with them. Maybe it's not the partner. Maybe it's the grandmother, mm-hmm. or maybe it's their best friend. And that person already has a good connection to that child. It's a kind of attachment, but not the one we're talking about. And it's very important. And most families, when they have a child by birth, the grandmothers compete for who's coming for the first 2 weeks and who's coming for the second, and they come and move in and help get the family organized. And, mm-hmm. and the mom and the dad get to say, or the parents get to say, what the role of that visiting grandparent is. We'd rather have you do the dishes and cook dinner and hold the baby for an hour while I take a shower. We don't want you holding the baby all the time because we're trying to, just explain.
Yeah.
It's so obvious.
Yeah. And compromise a little. So
sure.
You got to take a shower. Or you and your husband want to go out for a walk around the block?
Absolutely.
Well, then look for opportunities that
yep.
grandma and grandpa can be, and that you don't feel like they're stepping on your toes.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and that perhaps a little discussion beforehand would go a long way. Well, I think we have time for one last relatively quick question, and I'm going to summarize it. It's not just parents who are attaching, but if there are children already in the family, we need to be cognizant of attachment between siblings. Any suggestions?
Absolutely. This is such an important thing that we should have started with it, Dawn, because I think that most agencies and social workers don't spend as much time involving the other children. And I'll tell you, the small number of disruptions and dissolutions of adoptions that I've dealt with have directly related to the other children in the family and their response and their their traumatization. And I think that we really need to do a lot more work helping families to prepare and helping kids to understand what's going to happen, how it's going to be. The fantasy of just having a sibling that you didn't have is different than the reality of having this child who needs a huge amount of attention as they transition and get settled. So
I think the other
children really need a lot more attention and a lot more preparation.
And we have a list of books on our site for helping to prepare children for the adoption of a sibling. And that is certainly one way to do pre-preparation. Another way is to talk with your child about some of the ways that their new sibling might be reacting. Play act that with your child. Explain why their new brother or sister might be reacting the way they do. And also try to create opportunities that you have one-on-one time with the children that are already in the home.
Absolutely.
All right. One last thing. We just got an email from Michelle. That'll be our last thing. She said, I don't have two kids to compare, but I let everyone hold my son when I brought him home, family, friends, coworkers, and he is a very social child. At his baby shower, he was passed around for 10 hours. People were fighting to hold him, but no one doubts that he is bonded to me, and I mean no one. So I guess that's to say that indeed it is possible to, although I don't want people to necessarily go overboard, because I do encourage people to kind of simplify, if for no other reason than just the stress level from the parents. All right. Thank you, Dr. Pavo, for being our guest today on Creating a Family.
To get more information about
Dr. Pavo or about the Center for Family Connections, you can go to their website, which is KINNECT.org. This show will be archived on the 2011 Big List at the radio page of creatingafamily.org. And it's also available for a download as a podcast from iTunes. The easiest way to find it on iTunes is to use the iTunes button on our radio page. To stay in touch with the latest developments in adoption or infertility, as well as receive the upcoming week's blog and show topic, sign up for our weekly newsletter at creatingafamily.org. The UN estimates that there are 143 million orphans in the world, including 115,000 currently available for adoption in the U.S. foster system. These kids, as well as the millions of older kids throughout the world, deserve a home. To get more information about U.S. kids waiting for a family, you can go to the adoption resource page of our website, where we include links to various photo listings of some of these kids. Thanks for joining us today, and I will see you next week.